from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll talk with Dr. Jim Glass about his upcoming architecture talk.
I'll chat with author Dan Wakefield about the re-release of his book, Under the Apple Tree.
And I'll get a preview of the Gustav Bauman exhibit at the IMA, and we'll have that arts calendar recall.
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Preservationist, architectural historian, and consultant Dr. Jim Glass will give an illustrated lecture called Roman and Renaissance Architecture early next month. And Sharon Gamble wondered how these two regions and styles might relate to one another. Here's Sharon's conversation with Dr. Glass.
What was the inspiration for the trip on which your talk is based?
Well, I've taken two trips to Italy over the years, and the inspiration was Italy is a sort of a promised land for Western architecture, and I'm an architectural historian and studied in graduate school at Cornell, and always been fascinated by the cornucopia of creative energies that were unleashed by both Roman and Renaissance architecture. So the trips were an opportunity, in part, to see some of those wonderful monuments, and this lecture is an opportunity to sort of share some of my enthusiasm and what I've learned about it, fully illustrated with slides and pictures.
How is it that that Rome became essentially the architectural capital of the ancient world, anyway?
Well, I think that's in large part due to its political power and how large the empire was, how astute they were in spreading their influence and conquering one of the largest empires in the world at that time, one of the great empires of human history, all around the Mediterranean. They also spread the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, and Roman culture was sort of standardized. The peoples around the Mediterranean, many of them use Latin as a language. The empire was bound together by roads, and the architecture spread throughout. This began in Italy, spread throughout the empire. So that was really a key to that.
Now, you can't think Rome without almost simultaneously thinking churches and cathedrals. What is the relationship, or is there a relationship, between religious buildings and government buildings in Rome?
Well, Rome, Roman architecture, is really a very, even though it borrowed a lot from the Greeks, the Romans developed a highly original architecture, well-suited to be adapted to many different types of building forms, including temples and churches. So, of course, temples came first because the Romans had their own gods and temples were built to them. The temples they built were the familiar multi-columned form with a pediment and triangle roof that we're used to from Greece, but also used in Rome. That was really not suitable for churches when the Christian religion was adopted as state religion in the Roman Empire by the Emperor Constantine. And so,
why not?
Well, because temples were not places in which there were congregations. Temples were places where there was a cult statue of the god, and you came in briefly, paid your homage to the god, and left.
So it was an individual experience.
More of an individual experience, and the Christian religion called for a congregation to gather to worship. And so they adapted another Roman building type, the basilica, which had been a secular building, which was actually a marketplace where also Roman justice was administered, which had a central nave and two aisles on either side of it, and adapted that. Emperor Constantine actually adapted that for the original St. Peter's in Rome and several other churches, and that became the standard form for Christian churches for the next 2,000 almost 2,000 years.
So take us back a little ways, because there was an architectural and engineering feat that allowed those domes to be built, right?
Yes. The Romans were had some of the greatest engineers in human history, I think, in terms of their technical prowess and their originality. And the Romans came up with a form of concrete, really the first use of concrete in an extensive form. Their concrete was different than modern concrete. Their concrete was a form of rough aggregate together with a very strong mortar. And they were able to cure, refine that concrete until it could become cured shells for domes. And so the dome really owes its use in Genesis in a major form to the Romans.
Is there, you know, when you were talking about the difference between a temple and a place for a congregation, were acoustics part of the consideration in the difference between those two kinds of buildings?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, you have to get in a time machine, wouldn't you? Yeah.
I do not know. Acoustics, particularly for the processions and the liturgy of the church, acoustics would be important. In a temple, I'm not so sure how much. But
mm-hmm. So when you went, this was your first trip to Rome? This tour,
I made one trip in 96 and made another one in 2006.
Okay. And so it strikes me that would be almost overwhelming for someone who's looking at architecture. Where do you start?
You may not be surprised. I made a list.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I had a list of in terms of architectural history, great monuments of architecture, both of the Romans, and of course, unfortunately, most of the great Roman monuments are in ruins, except for the Pantheon in Rome, which is one of the great experiences I think anyone can have, is to walk into that building, which is nearly 1,900 years, and see a major temple, major public buildings of the Romans, just as the Romans experienced it, with a richly colored marble floors, columns, and that wonderful soaring dome with the oculus at the very top, just as it was 1,900 years ago. So that was obviously on my list. But also many Renaissance churches, palaces, Baroque buildings I had. And then in a place like Venice, you just sort of want to immerse yourself in the experience, which is really unique in that city.
Is there a preservation aesthetic or ethic in Rome the way we might think of one here in the States?
Well, I think it's a good question. Sure. I think that that's been something that's come on in the last 150 to 200 years. Unfortunately, I have to say that some of the Renaissance popes actually raided the marbles of ancient Rome in order to build their churches in the Renaissance. So they were not the sort of robbing from Paul
materials
to pay Peter type thing. but that was not unusual at the time. But in the 19th century, archaeology was really the beginnings of preservation, I think, in Rome. In the 18th century, they began to discover the Roman Forum and some of their ancient ruins. And preservation consciousness came on gradually, and really in the last 125 years is pretty strong.
So on this trip, you got to look at these amazing ancient structures that are in more or less states of wholeness, and then shifting gears to look at the effects of the Renaissance.
Yes, and there's a close connection, as most of the people are aware of, between Rome and Renaissance. Renaissance was an era of rediscovery, really, of the antique or the ancient architecture of the Romans. There were a number of Renaissance-era architects in Italy who actually studied the ancient Roman ruins, measured them, made drawings. The famous architect Palladio actually spent much time in Rome doing measured drawings. In fact, some of his measured drawings, the only record we have of some major Roman buildings which have been demolished since then.
Mm.
So they were very aware of the ancient ruins, and they were building modern Renaissance architecture based on what they learned or knew what they knew of the Romans. The Roman architecture, just as the Roman classics and Roman culture generally, and the humanists and so on, was revered, and so the architects were using as much as they could to build modern buildings.
What are some of the improvements they made, though, if they were emulating the beauty? Were there physical changes? Were there updates?
Yes. I think they were using forms such as columns, pilasters. They were using the vocabulary of the Romans, the arches. The dome had never really completely disappeared in Italy, but it was revived, starting with Brunelleschi and the Cathedral of Florence, Duomo of Florence. They were building modern buildings, though, so the Roman vocabulary was often used to clothe modern buildings, which had new functions, because the Romans' building functions, many of those didn't have equivalents in the Renaissance period. So churches, they liked the idea of centralized churches, which you have a centralized dome with four equal arms. That was not suited to the liturgy of the Roman Catholic Church as much. So, but there were some of these centralized churches which were quite interesting, and they had sources in the Roman Empire for centralized buildings like that, so they used that. But the Latin cross still overall became dominant. Palaces, these were modern buildings, but with the pilasters and Roman classical orders, arcades, which sometimes were quite literally taken from Roman buildings and sometimes were inventive things. And I think something to stress about the Italian Renaissance is they, like the Romans, were original and creative people.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would use Roman buildings and vocabulary and then put their own stamp of originality on it. That was true of Michelangelo, one of the great architects of the Renaissance. He was a very inventive person, and so you wouldn't see in an ancient Roman building some of the ways he used the columns and the entablatures and so on, in very original kind of ways.
Do you get a sense that that contemporary Italians cherish this architecture of previous times, or is there more of a, oh, that's old, we need to move on, let's do our own thing for our generation?
I guess I'd have to say that the Italians, perhaps more than Americans, treasure their architectural past today, and not just the Romans and the Renaissance, but all the periods, even up through the 19th century.
Hmm.
They also have conserved the countryside through legislation they have, and so there are green spaces. There's a high density of population in the ancient cities, but within those cities, the integrity of the building fabric, the city fabric, is quite extraordinary. If you go to Florence, for example, you can experience many of the Renaissance buildings, palazzos, churches, and things that were there in 1500s and 1600s, and you can't say that in many other places in the world.
Sure. Speaking of inspiration, did you have the experience of turning a corner, looking at a building, and saying, oh my gosh, I know something back home that's been influenced
yes.
by this?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things I'd like to bring out in this presentation is the legacy of the Romans and Renaissance for us here in Indianapolis in the United States. So I'm going to be showing some buildings that have their legacy directly from that. I'll give a couple examples. The Old City Hall, in many ways, is a Roman building of the Roman Empire. It has multicolored marble floors and patterns, which are drawn directly from Roman palaces. The State House is a high Italian Renaissance building. There are columns and the atriums were drawn directly from Brunelleschi in Florence.
Hmm.
And the pilasters on the outside are gigantic and were used by Michelangelo Bramante and other famous architects. So we have a rich legacy which draws directly from the Romans and the later Italian architects up through the 15th and 16th century, and Baroque also.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Jim Glass. If his name sounds familiar, you might have read his monthly column in the Indianapolis Star. His talk, Roman and Renaissance Architecture, will be on Monday, November 10th at 7:30 at the Riviera Club Ballroom, 5640 North Illinois Street. The talk is free of charge and open to the public.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Author Dan Wakefield first published Under the Apple Tree in 1982. The book looks at the home front in World War II through the eyes of a 10-year-old boy whose older brother goes off to war and the girlfriend he leaves behind. The boy's duty is to see that she doesn't sit under the apple tree with anyone else. The book was recently re-released in a new edition, and Travis DiNicola spoke with Dan about the book.
Dan, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Under the Apple Tree has just been re-released. Congratulations on that. I know it came out originally in 85, and it's great to have the book back in print.
Yeah.
We're going to have you read from it in a bit and certainly talk about the book, but I want to start by asking you to tell me a bit how this book came to be, because I know there's a story about you sitting on the roof of your house when you were a kid.
Yes, sitting on the roof of my porch at 6129 Winthrop. And I was looking for enemy airplanes through a pair of binoculars. And I was a Boy Scout and a junior air raid warden. And I had memorized the silhouettes of Messerschmitts, Stukas, and Zeros. And I was convinced that Indianapolis would be a prime target of the Germans and the Japanese. And my feeling was that if they could knock out Indianapolis, they would knock out the heart of the country. That mm-hmm. would be the end of morale. So that was my rationale for it.
Do you remember? So this is during World War II. And do you remember where did you have playing cards that had the silhouettes of the fighters on them?
No. It was a book.
It was a book. Oh,
okay. And they were quite large silhouettes, and you memorized those and looked for them. And, of course, we never saw one enemy plane over Indianapolis.
Which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. That was in our imagination. See, I had already, with the Boy Scouts, collected 1,000 pounds of scrap paper and innumerable pots and pans. We were told, I think it was in Life magazine, that if you could collect 700 pots or pans, that would be the equivalent of the wing of a P-39 fighter plane.
Wow.
So that was a great inspiration. And of course, one of the great songs of the times was Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree mm-hmm. with Anyone Else But Me. And that really gave me the idea of the plot of the book, because the idea of the time was just remembering myself on the roof with binoculars looking for enemy airplanes. And I thought, my gosh, if you could explain why an otherwise rational kid of 11 or 12 was doing that, you could explain a whole world that existed then.
Yeah.
And but then that left, you can't write a whole book about a kid looking for enemy airplanes that never appear. So I imagine, the song of Under the Apple Tree was Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. So the idea was for girlfriends of soldiers who went off to war to not hang out with other guys. Mm-hmm. Of course, there weren't very many other guys to hang out with. But so I thought, well, the boy should have for the story an older brother who goes off to war, and it's the boy's mission to protect or look after or spy on the girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any brothers and sisters, and I had a cousin who lived next door who was kind of like an older brother, and he was a tail gunner on a B-17. But in my imagination, in my story, I wanted the older brother to go to the South Pacific and fight mm-hmm. in that theater of war. And there was a boy down our block on Winthrop who joined the Marines. So I thought, well, I'll make him like that guy who joins the Marines and
sure.
might go to the South Pacific. So I was really able to get in the elements of World War II on the home front.
And how it affected everybody.
That's right. Everyone
who was left behind, from yeah. kids to girlfriends yeah. to parents.
And, of course, there was rationing mm-hmm. of food, there was rationing of gasoline. I remember I was very proud that my father was a pharmacist, so he got a B ration card for gas. If you're a doctor, I think you got a C card, but if you're an ordinary citizen, you just got an A card. You could only get very few gallons of gas. But the amazing thing, I think it was the one time in American history when Americans were, for the most part, very united, very clear in their purpose for the issues of this war were very clear cut, unlike the wars we've fought since. And I wanted to just read a part that, to me, summed up what feeling was. And this is through the minds of the boy who's 12 years old. He said, in the crisp, clear days of October, America was beautiful, just like in the song. Artie had never been from sea to shining sea, had never seen the purple mountain majesty, but he knew they were out there, believed in them, and saw every day with his own eyes the beauty of the gentle hills, the creeks and cornfields, the solid old white frame houses, and the ancient oaks of town. He believed, in fact, that God had shed his grace on this land, that this grace was tangible, visible, in the arch of rainbows over wet fields, the slant of shed sunlight on the sides of barns. His pride in his country was sustained by the signs of nature and the symbols of men, not only the bright stars and stripes that flew from public buildings and hung from private porches, but the comforting, everyday emblems of home. Bob's Eats, Joe's Premium, Mail Pouch Tobacco. This was what Roy, his brother, and all the other boys were fighting to save, preserve, and protect, along with the people who were lucky enough to live in and of it. And all this was sacred, worthy of any sacrifice, including life itself, for without it, life would be hollow and dumb.
Dan, this book it's not actually set in Indianapolis, though it very well could be.
Yes, I had set one novel in Indianapolis called Going All the Way, and that caused me such grief that I decided I would never do that again, so that I wouldn't have people claiming, oh, they're this or that character, and this or that happened. So I imagined a town in the Midwest that I just made up in my mind called Burney, Illinois. But it was really based on my experience growing up in Broad Ripple. And at that time, Broad Ripple was a real close-knit neighborhood. It was not yet called a village, which always has kind of perplexed me. I imagine a village peopled with elves, but we were proud of it just as a neighborhood.
So the this book, Under the Apple Tree, it's a very, very sweet story. It begins in sort of a very sweet way of this young boy thinking about his brother and sort of, you know, protecting the home front. But it also deals with a lot of issues of how difficult it was for the families and friends of the people who went overseas in World War II, and also all the really difficult problems they had when they came back.
Yes, and I like to say another thing. It was very difficult for Italians, for Germans, especially for Japanese who were American citizens.
Sure.
You know, I didn't know till the 90s that Japanese American citizens were rounded up on the West Coast and sent to internment camps. And everything in the book that I quote from a magazine or newspaper is an actual quote. And I just want to read a very brief thing. Will show how crazy this kind of fear sure. particularly for the Japanese. This was an article in Time magazine, and it said how to tell the Chinese your friend from the Japanese your enemy. It said,
wow.
Those who know them best often rely on their facial characteristics to tell them apart. The Chinese expression is likely to be placid, kindly, open. The Japanese more positive, dogmatic, arrogant. Most Chinese avoid horn-rimmed spectacles. Japanese are nervous in conversation, laugh loudly at the wrong time. Japs are likely to be stockier and broader-hipped. Well, this is sort of the hysteria and craziness. And in grade school, we were given a war stamp book in which you saved up your dimes and bought a stamp, mm-hmm. and you filled up this book by placing the stamps over the fang-like, blood-dripping faces of Japanese soldiers,
wow.
and it said, slap the Jap right off the map. So it was a very hard time for American, really, citizens who were deprived of their citizenship in many cases and put in these internment camps. And I was very happy to recently learn that people who wanted to get out of the camps and go to the Midwest or East, where there wasn't such a fear of Japanese Americans, one of the places that they were invited to come was Indianapolis, and people from the Disciples of Christ Church, which had had missionaries for many years in Japan, helped this effort. And sort of to my amazement, Indianapolis is one of the places that welcomed them, and a wonderful paper by a scholar here, a Japanese-American woman named Nancy Connor. The end of her paper recounting this says, when the call came, there were people in Indianapolis who were prepared to answer. And I was very proud that in the midst of that hysteria, there were people right here who were willing to help Japanese Americans get jobs and mm-hmm. be resettled and treated as citizens.
So knowing that now and understanding that part, that very complicated part of the history,
yeah,
I have to imagine that, you know, if you were to write Under the Apple Tree now, it might be somewhat different than the book you wrote in 85.
Well, I don't think it would be, because what I was trying to do and what I've always tried to do when I write books in a particular time is to present what was the feeling and issues of that era. And I've sometimes been confused that I'm trying to promote those issues, but I'm trying to reflect what it was. And I think most people in the city didn't know about this very
sure.
good effort. And in fact, I think many people would have been upset by it. So it wasn't well publicized. But to boys, to school children, boys mm-hmm. and girls, they would have had a very different picture, and they would have been bombarded by propaganda and all the songs. You know, there was a song, a popular song called Goodbye Mama, I'm Off to Yokohama for My Country and You, the Red, White, and Blue. So that was the predominant feeling of, and then there was a song called Will Heil, Heil Right in Der Fuhrer's Face. So anything to make the enemy more than bad, more of a caricature, was
sure.
part of that era.
Dan, let me ask you a bit about how this came to be that you have the book re-released now.
Well, Hawthorne Publishing, which is really Art and Nancy Baxter and Carmel, had read the book and thought that then since this is the 70th anniversary of the end of the war, mm-hmm. it would be appropriate to do a new edition. And it is a very beautiful new edition with a new preface by a writer who wrote a very good nonfiction book about the era called Don't You Know There's a War On, a man named Richard Lingerman, who, by the way, has written biographies of Dreiser and Sinclair Lewis. And I didn't know, I've known him for many years in New York, but I didn't know till recently he's from Crawfordsville. Hmm. So the book has an all-Indiana writing cast.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it's great that it has this new edition out for people to be able to enjoy. Of course, many people have become more familiar with your work through recently the Vonnegut letters that you edited and Vonnegut speeches, as well as moving back to Indianapolis over the past couple of years and being part of our literary scene here.
Yes, and part of Indy Reed's books, which has been a great ally of me and many authors, and has been like a real pillar of support for writing and for writers here in the city.
Well, thank you for saying that. And thank you for coming into Art of the Matter today. It's great to have Under the Apple Tree available again for people to enjoy and read. And it really is just a terrific read. And pardon me if I pretend that the book is set in Indianapolis, even though I know it's not.
Yes, that's okay.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks.
Travis DiNicola with author Dan Wakefield. Dan's book, Under the Apple Tree, was just re-released in a new edition published by Hawthorne Publishing. It's available at Indy Reads Books. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what's scary this week?
What?
How little time there is to make your costume plans for Halloween.
That's right.
And we'll have some places for you to wear your costume on that calendar we call
What'll We Do? Ooh, boo, that's right.
What do you have?
You know, I think I might dress up as Kurt Vonnegut, maybe. No, but we just heard the interview that I got to do with Dan Wakefield, mm-hmm. and as part of Kurt Vonnegut, Vonnegut Fest, which is coming up, Vonnegut Fest 2015, which is coming up the weekend of November 5th through the 7th, one of the things, if you'd like to actually hear Dan Wakefield, along with a whole bunch of other people, including journalist and 60 Minutes correspondent Steve Croft, they're going to be doing a panel discussion about Vonnegut and religion with Christian Theological Seminary, and it's going to be at Christian Theological Seminary, and will be a very cool thing. That's on Friday, November 6th, if you'd like to hear that. But also did want to mention that I am going to be moderating a panel with a number of Indiana authors, including Dan Wakefield, also Barb Shoup and Lou Harry and Jeff Knurk, who does The Jumble. And we're going to be at the JCC on Tuesday, November 3rd at 7:30 as part of their ANCATS Festival of Books.
Absolutely. Very good. Hey, if you want to be creeped out by spooky organ music, you can... That's very appropriate. Phantom of the Opera is the silent film being screened as part of this year's Silent Halloween at Indiana Landmark Center. It is not on Halloween night. It's on the night before, October 30th, and there will be some snacks and some themed beverages, and you're welcome to dress up the theme this year, Phantom of the Opera, or just opera in general. You can find out more about that at Silent Halloween on Eventbrite or Silent Halloween at Indiana Landmark Center. You really should do voice work at this time of your trip.
I know, I love it. I guess I'm on a book theme. Book Mamas has a bunch of cool events coming up this weekend. On Friday from 5:30 to 8:30, they've got Abe Amador with a book launch. He's signing his new book, Monastery of Writers. And it's a tale about a writer's group that meets in an abandoned resort hotel in Indiana, which sounds like a lot of fun. And then on Sunday, the 25th, from 2 to 4, Frieda Love Smith, who is a former rock drummer and current food blogger, is signing her new book, Red Velvet Underground, a rock memoir with recipes, which sounds awesome as well. And yes, refreshments will be served at Book Mamas in Irvington.
They better be. Hey, this next event is not scary at all. It's part of the Spirit and Place Festival. It's Gail Payne's Cabaret Show. that participates with the dream theme. It's called Let It Shine, and I said show, but there are actually two shows. They're both on November 8th, which is a Sunday, at the Jazz Kitchen, one at 5:45 and one at 7:30. Selections from the Great American Songbook, Broadway, jazz, and popular music with great local jazz performers accompanying Gail Payne in her cabaret singing show.
Very cool. And as they say, much, much more.
Much, much more.
That's right. Well, if you want to learn more about local arts events, you can always do so at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website. Or, of course, you can listen to us and get some more Halloween costume ideas on that calendar we call What'll We Boo?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Though he was born in Germany and made a career in Chicago, Gustav Bauman became one of ours, a bona fide Hoosier artist. Bauman's woodblock prints are the subject of Gustav Bauman, German Craftsman, American Artist, opening at the Indianapolis Museum of Art October 25th. Sharon Gamble got curator Marty Krause to tell us more.
Though he was born in Germany, Gustav Bauman identified a lot with Indiana. How did he end up here?
Well, he really came for a vacation. He was working as a commercial artist in Chicago, where his family had settled in 1891 when he was 10. And his father left the family just a few years later, so Gus had to go to work. And he sort of went into the commercial art field and was very good at it.
And he apprenticed to an engraver, right?
Yes.
Wasn't that one of his first
He worked in the art department of an engraving house, when he was 16 years old. And, you know, by 1900, when he was, 19 or 20, he had his own studio in the Loop. And he spent a year back in Germany learning sort of arts and crafts, basically, at the Applied Art School in Munich. And one of those arts and crafts was block printing, and he sort of took to it and decided that that would be the niche in the art world that he would pursue. So while he was still doing commercial art in Chicago in 1910, he was also doing independent prints, and he needed a sort of a break from the sort of grind.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking for sort of respite. His studio was 10 floors above Michigan Avenue in the old Fine Arts Building, not far from the
hubbub,
Art Institute.
Right,
exactly.
In the center of town.
So he had had friends in sort of a commercial artist club called the Palette and Chisel Club who had been coming down to Brown County for the past couple of years. So he took the train and he was planning on spending the summer just sort of essentially vacationing or doing artwork. And then head back to Chicago. But he took to the place so much that, and it was so inexpensive in those years. You could board for $4 a week and, find a place to stay for the same amount, that he just decided to stay on. And for all intents and purposes, he stayed for the next 6 years.
You know, that's a really radical move from a commercial center and literally in the middle of the city of Chicago to rural Indiana. How did he support himself?
Well, he maintained his studio in Chicago
and would occasionally go back to
do commercial work. And he continued to do that the entire time he was in Brown County. But, he was coming into his own as an independent woodblock printmaker. In 1915, while he was in Brown County, he won a gold medal for printmaking at the Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco. And that sort of identified him as one of the leading lights in American printmaking because, though there were several gold medals, his was the only one for woodblock printmaking. And the prints that he won it for were Brown County prints. So in a way, he was very instrumental in putting Brown County on the national map, maybe more so than T.C. Steele and some of his other colleagues.
Were there other printmakers in the Brown County artist colony, or was he?
Well, yes. L.O. Griffith, who was a friend of his from Chicago, also a member of the Palette and Chisel Club, was a printmaker, though he settled in Brown County later. He was still sort of a seasonal painter when he would come down to Brown County during Bauman's tenure, but settled in Brown County in the 20s. And then there were some later ones as well. But at the time that Bauman was there, he was really it. You know, Will Vauder and Adolph Schulz occasionally did prints. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for all intents and purposes, the only professional printmaker in Brown County in the teens was Gustav Bauman.
So I need a little education. There were a couple of leading techniques for making prints. There was a Japanese technique and then the technique that Bauman practiced. Can you describe the differences?
Well, basically, the key difference is that in sort of the European tradition or the German tradition, which Bauman sort of learned and continued throughout his life, you print on a press and your colors are printed flat. In a Japanese print, the colors are washed on like watercolor and then transferred to the paper just by rubbing the back of the paper, which is on top of the block. So there's a very sort of aqueous look to Japanese prints, and Bauman's have a heartier look to them because the colors are...
They're crisper, right?
Yes, and they're stronger colors. They're not as translucent as the Japanese inks, though they are not opaque, they're also translucent. So if you overprint two colors, you'll get a third.
Mm-hmm. I picture the era when he was working, although he had a really long life. He lived to be 90, right?
Indeed.
From the 1880s to the 1970s. So that's a huge long life. But I picture sort of his early years as kind of a golden age of engravings as illustrations in magazines and newspapers.
Sure.
and commercial art.
Yes, and he did some of that as well. I mean, he did illustrate books, and he did use woodcuts for commercial advertising. It was sort of the end of that era because photographic or photoreproductive processes were being perfected, and they were a lot cheaper than hiring somebody to do the manual labor of actually creating a wood engraved or woodcut advertisement. And it was also sort of the arts and crafts era where these sorts of hand created, particularly wood products, were very much in vogue. So there were a great number of color woodblock printmakers in the United States and across the world at the turn of the 20th century. Now, most of them in later years sort of moved on to other things, whereas Bauman stayed true to his calling, and indeed he considered it a calling. His philosophy was to make inexpensive, though original art for the masses or for the widest possible public possible. And he stuck to that throughout his life. And since a print can be multiplied 100 times or 125 times, the unit price is less than a painting. The actual labor that goes into creating that basic print, the first print, is much more complicated than doing a painting. But you do have the advantage of being able to print it again and again, and therefore the costs were low. His first prints in Brown County cost $5 a piece.
Wow.
And, you know, at the end of his life, he was charging $100.
You mentioned before I turned the microphone on that his wife kind of nudged him to up his prices.
Sure. He certainly could have. You know, there was certainly enough of a market for it. But he wanted to maintain the sort of egalitarian access to his artwork and therefore couldn't be convinced to charge more than that. You know, you have to applaud him for that. And, you know, he certainly was able to make a living by his art, which very few artists ever are, though, you know, it was a fairly modest living.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so handy that, you know, he designed his own house. He designed and built his own furniture. So many of the expenditures of life he was able to do himself, which was just an aspect of his artistic being, and was able, therefore, to live much more modestly than and Santa Fe, where he ended up living for the majority of life, was a lot cheaper in 1920 than it is in 2015.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know?
But, man, he really is a product of, in some ways, the arts and crafts movement.
Sure.
With that belief that anybody of reasonable intelligence can figure out how to sew his own curtains or cook his own
food
or whatever.
And he sort of came by it naturally. His father was a cabinet maker, so the idea of woodworking was something that he had grown up with. So he sort of combined his natural aptitude for woodworking with an innate sort of artistic sense, which, you know, he sort of denied. He said, "I'm a craftsman by birth and an artist by accident," but it really wasn't true. I mean, he had a true artistic sense. If you look at his woodblock prints, they strike you as, you know, small oil paintings, and nothing could be farther from the actuality of how they were produced, because in a painting you sort of put the paint on the brush and the brush on the canvas. In a woodblock print, you cut away everything but the equivalent of that brushstroke. So it really is quite remarkable. And he had, you know, again, part of that sort of arts and crafts tradition. He ground his own pigments, and he mixed his own paints, and mixed his own printing inks. And there's a very idiosyncratic color sense that you will find in Bauman's work that you will find in none other.
And throughout his career, it stayed stable.
Yes.
So tell us about how did he get started going out to Santa Fe?
Well, again, it was on the sort of encouragement of old friends from the Palette and Chisel Club. There were sort of two painters, Walter Ufer and Victor Higgins, who had been in the commercial art field in Chicago at the same time Bauman were members of the Palette and Chisel Club. And they had gone out to Taos, New Mexico, in 1914, and continued then annually to go out there. And it was such a different place, particularly from those from the tamed landscapes of the Midwest or the East. It was so far different, and its otherness was just absolutely seductive to Eastern artists. So they encouraged Gus to come out. Which he did in 1918. And he really enjoyed himself, though he felt he really hadn't adapted to the differentness of the landscape and the atmosphere of New Mexico. But he had wanted to come back. So as he was in Santa Fe to catch the train back to Chicago, he just happened to run into the curator from the art museum in Santa Fe, a fellow named Paul Walter, and since Bauman had some works on view at the museum at that very time, he asked them whether he'd come back. And Bauman said, "Yes, but I can't stay because I'm broke." And Walter said, "Well, how much would it take to induce you to stay?" And Bauman said, "Well, I probably could get by on $500. And Walter said, "Well, we'll get it done," because Walter also happened to be a director of the First National Bank of Santa Fe, which was right across the street from the art museum. So he arranged this loan for Bauman, and Bauman settled in and really never left.
Right place, right time.
Absolutely.
You have a fascinating artist-in-residency program going on with this exhibition. Let's talk about that.
Yes, we're going to have a block printmaker actually in the gallery, actually sequestered from the artwork, but within the gallery space, who will be doing demonstrations and teaching classes and be there to answer questions. So it should be, I think it's the first time we've ever done that
within
the space. But it makes perfect sense because the process is so integral to the end product in a woodblock print. And we're going to be dealing with that pretty comprehensively within the exhibition with, displays of blocks and progressive proofs on how you build up an image to the final product. But this will actually be a living, breathing person who is adept at making prints and can answer questions of people going through the exhibition. So we're looking forward to that.
So is the way Leslie Dolan makes prints, that has the technology changed? Or
no, basically it's the same. I mean, it really isn't any different than Lucas Cranach in, 1505. Woodblock printmaking is the oldest form of printmaking. And in its basic form, it goes back to China. But in Europe, it sort of is a product of the Renaissance. And, it was developed as a way to illustrate books because the process of cutting away everything but the image, if you can think of a typewriter key, if you're old enough to remember what a typewriter key is, that raised surface is what will carry the ink. And obviously you can print the woodblock illustration then with the type in a book because they're both the same process. So, that process, format was developed by 1450 at the same time Gutenberg and the movable type. And becomes quite an art form, not only for book illustration, but also for independent works of art, you know, in the hands of a master like Durer or Cranach by the end of the 15th century. And they began printing in color at the same time, or at least rudiments of color. And each color in a woodblock print requires the cutting of its own separate block so the inks won't mix. And then each block has to be printed sequentially to build up the final image. And that basic technique was developed early in the 16th century, and that really hasn't changed. I mean, the materials may have changed a bit, but the basic process remained the same.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis Museum of Art Curator of Prints, Drawings, and Photographs, Martin Krauss. Marty is also a nationally recognized Bauman specialist. Gustav Bauman, German craftsman, American artist, opens at the IMA October 25th. Learn more and sign up to try your hand at making woodblock prints at imamuseum.org. Again, imamuseum.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of one of this year's Spirit and Place events.
I'll chat with actor Nick Abiel about the show he created on Off-Broadway that he's bringing back to his hometown through the Fringe Fest.
And I'll find out about the Sacred Journeys exhibit at the Children's Museum, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.